What would you do if you learned that someone you loved had a fatal disease, and one that is so rare that drug companies, they're just not devoting large sums of money to developing a cure? Would you take matters into your own hands? I mean, could you? So maybe you could seek out scientists whose work may lead to a cure, raise money to fund the basic research, the safety trials, the clinical trials, to try to find a cure before it's too late? Well, this hour we're going to talk about two brothers who did just that. One diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and the other is a mechanical engineer who turned his talents to the field of genetic engineering to push for a cure for his brother. We're also going to talk with an ALS researcher and a clinician about the latest advances in understanding just what goes wrong in the body to cause ALS and what progress is being made to treat this disease, from new drugs to gene therapy to stem cells. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd like to talk more with us, please get on the phone or surf over to our website at Science Friday, where we might have more information. Let me introduce my guests. Jonathan Weiner is a science writer. He comes from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He's author of His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine, published this year by Echo Press. He's here with us in Science Friday Studios. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ira. Nice to be here.
Nice to see you again. Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein is a professor of neurology and neuroscience, the director of the Robert Packard Center for ALS Research and co-director of the MDA ALS Clinic at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, and he joins us from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rothstein.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for inviting me.
This book, Jonathan, His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine, tells a very interesting story. Tell us about Stephen Haywood.
Stephen is a young carpenter. He grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. He was just finishing his first house at the age of 29 when he noticed that he was having trouble turning the key in the front door. And that was the beginning of an unraveling. Neurologists diagnosed him with ALS and told him that he had 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years to live. His brother Jamie then leaped on the scene, as you were saying.
And his brother decided he would. He's an engineer. His brother.
That's right.
And he took his engineering macho and said, no one else is working on this. I'm going to try to work on this myself.
That's it. I think engineers have that sense of problem solving. Jamie is an MIT techie. He has a tremendous sense. He sometimes calls it hubris, but he has a sense that he can solve any problem if he knows enough about it. He felt he was working at that time not on an engineering job, but at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego, which is a wonderful think tank for the neurosciences. So he was surrounded by people who think a lot about what goes wrong with nerves and brains. And ALS is a neurodegenerative disease, a nerve death disease. So he had wonderful mentors as well, and that encouraged him to make this leap into gene therapy.
Jeff Rothstein, is that typical the first symptom of ALS that he suffered?
Yes, it's not uncommon for patients to first experience a weakness in their arms or legs. In a subset of patients, the first symptom manifestation might be a slurring of speech.
Mm-hmm. And at that age group, at that age that he suffered?
It's not as common in a younger age group. But there's no question we see it in the younger populations. It's much more common in a middle-aged 44 through 54 age group.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Jeff Rothstein and Jonathan Weiner about ALS and the very interesting story that Jonathan has talked about in his Brother's Keeper. What's the future for ALS research and how this family tackled it and how it actually intersected with Jonathan's own life? So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about ALS and with my guests, Jonathan Weiner, science writer in Bucks County and author of His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine, just out by Echo Press. Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein, professor of neurology and neuroscience, director of the Robert Packard Center for ALS Research and co-director of the MDA ALS Clinic at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Rothstein, what goes wrong in the body when ALS happens?
So ALS is a disease that, for the most part, only affects a very small number of cells in the brain and spinal cord of patients. It's the cells known as the motor neurons. These are the primary neurons, those cells that drive muscle movements, mm-hmm. movements that control your arms, your legs, your ability to swallow, and your ability to breathe. It's a disease that doesn't affect, for the most part, your ability to think, smell, mm-hmm. see, taste, mm-hmm. just your voluntary motor movements. And when those cells die, over time, slowly over time, patients develop a very progressive weakness, often asymmetrically on one arm or another arm, and spreading around the body. And eventually, as it moves forward, it robs people of their ability to breathe. And that's why it's actually a fatal disease.
Mm-hmm. And the most famous case of ALS would be Stephen Hawking, who's lived an incredibly long time, hasn't he, with the disease?
Yes. Well, so there are actually many forms of motor neuron diseases. You have two populations of these cells, one in your brain, one population in your brain and one population in your spinal cord. And we know as physicians, neurologists, that there are some patients that only have the population of the brain affected, only in the spinal cord, and those are subtypes. And many of us feel that Stephen Hawking has a variant of ALS, mm-hmm. although I've not seen him as a patient, so I can't document that for sure. But he is a member of the motor neuron family of diseases.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jonathan, let's with that in mind, let's pick up your story. Dr. Rothstein has talked about how this is a progressive disease, so over the next few months, the weakness in Stephen's hands starts to move beyond, right? Behind his thumb and his forefinger, his whole hand is involved.
That's right. And Stephen and Jamie and their youngest brother, Ben, are very close. They do a lot of very physical stuff together. They love arm wrestling matches, Jamie and Stephen. And Jamie begins to beat his carpenter brother in spite of his having a desk job and being an engineer. And that's another sign that something is going wrong. The weakness continues to spread. And mm-hmm. Stephen went to see a series of doctors, first a GP and then a neurologist and then a series of neurologists. It wasn't clear for a while what the diagnosis really was, and that's also typical. I think Jeff can tell us that's also typical of this disease. It takes a while to be diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Is there a definite diagnosis, Dr. Rothstein, for this, or do you rule out things? You know, like we think of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, very much the rule out. There is no specific blood test or imaging analysis, and it is in the beginning can be a difficult diagnosis. Often by the time the patient reaches my own clinic or my colleagues' clinics, it's much easier because the disease has changed over time, but that's extremely frustrating for patients because those early changes and as you heard, in a single hand are not uncommon for compression of nerves, something we call carpal tunnel. Patients will often trip for a while, have a fall, and blame their initial disease on the fall that they had. And it's just that slow progression that mm-hmm. takes time to reach a stage where we can be sure it's ALS and, as you mentioned, rule out other diseases that can mimic ALS.
Mm-hmm. So, Jonathan, here we talked about Stephen Haywood being diagnosed with it, and his brother, as we mentioned before, comes onto the scene. And is it a good time in history of medicine for his brother to come on? Or?
I don't think this story would have taken place at another time. I think this was a time of tremendous optimism in the sciences and especially in biology.
What year were we?
We're talking 98, 99,
right.
The very end of the century, the end of the millennium, and I think everybody in biology and biomedicine and biology watchers all had this utopian feeling that the answers were coming in, the genome, human genome was almost sequenced, we had the fly genome sequence, now of course we're getting down to the rats, but we had right. so much information, and after a century of biology, we could do almost anything. And I think that added to the techie pride of a brilliant engineer like Jamie, who felt we have the parts. An engineer feels if you have the parts, the working parts, something's going wrong, you can fix it.
So what did Jamie do when he finds out his brother has this incurable disease?
Well, the first thing he did, which I still find incredible, is that he hung up the phone, getting that dreaded call from his brother, who had just left the clinic, with the diagnosis, or a very strong hint of the diagnosis. And he went on the web, and he started looking at papers. He Googled ALS prognosis. And to do that in itself takes tremendous guts. We'll talk at some point maybe about my own family's travels through something quite similar in parallel with the Haywoods, but I know I couldn't do that. I didn't do that.
You don't want to know. You just don't want to know, do you?
You just can't go there for a while. But Jamie dived right in, and very, very quickly, through scientists who took a strong interest in the story, he decided that Jeff Rothstein's work on a gene called EAT2, E-A-A-T-2, offered enormous promise, and that there was room for an entrepreneur like Jamie, because he's at least as much an entrepreneur as an engineer, to jump in and accelerate the research on EAT2 in time maybe to save Stephen. Not only to save Stephen from death by ALS, but to save him from being paralyzed. If he could move within months, he could save Stephen from a wheelchair. And that was what he tried.
So he finds Dr. Rothstein's paper on the internet. It's just an interesting story.
Almost that. He found out a lot on the internet, and then he started talking with Joe Galley, who's a neuroscientist and his office mate at the Neurosciences Institute. And Joe had been fascinated by Jeff's paper. Mm. And it was Joe, who's a brilliant neuroscientist with a great overview of neuroscience and molecular biology, who said, Jamie, if you're going to start anywhere, start with Rothstein's paper.
And Jeff Rothstein, tell us about that paper a little bit more than Jonathan has told us. What did you write in that paper?
Well, there's a story that evolves in terms of ALS, a story that's by no means over, as to trying to dissect the pathways that are involved in why these cells die. And one part of that story involved this protein, glutamate transporter known as EAAT2. And we knew years earlier that the protein was missing. And we knew from work from my lab and others that when it's missing, cells die, and in those cells include motor neurons. So we were trying to dissect what the mechanism for why that protein was missing. And the unusual part of that at the time, and the science has moved forward, was that this protein was missing not in the motor neurons that die, but in fact in the cells around the motor neurons, and that was perplexing at the time. Why would those cells be affected when in fact this is a disease of the motor neurons? Now, to feed forward, as of a year ago, we now know that those cells are in fact part of the disease process. They're critical for motor neuron disease to develop. But we didn't know that then when we were trying to understand what the molecular events were that underlied this loss of EAAT2, and we published this interesting observation that it could have been the RNA or the DNA machinery responsible for making this protein was making lots of errors. We and others have subsequently found that, in fact, those kinds of errors include in other diseases, other neurodegenerative diseases as well. But that was our first observation that this pathway could be disrupted in ALS.
Mm-hmm. So, Jonathan, tell us about now the gene therapy project of Jamie's. He takes on a project.
Jamie realized within weeks of studying Jeff Rothstein's paper, talking with Jeff on the phone, talking with a lot of other neuroscientists, that there really might be a possibility to adapt this EAT2 work to a gene therapy. And once he decided that he might be able to do it, he felt as if a clock was ticking very loudly now, and that every day of his life was worth 30 days to Stephen, because in a matter of a month, he thought he would be able to put together a top-notch team of scientists to implement the gene therapy. Gene therapy, as we know, is an incredibly complicated and difficult process with a very problematic track record. But Jamie thought if he could put together a great team fast, he'd have a shot. So he and his wife, Melinda, drove full speed across the country, back to home, back to Newton, Mass., moved in with their parents. Stephen was already living there now, and began this incredible networking and put together a team that included Jeff at Hopkins and Matt Turing, who was then at Jefferson Medical Center in Philadelphia, a very well-known gene therapist.
And Matt Turing was trying to design gene therapies for the disease, and he's important in the story.
He is. Matt was already on the map as the guy who had tried the first gene therapy for a neurodegenerative disease.
Jeff Brothstein, you were one of the scientists Jamie recruited, and you agreed to try the gene therapy on mice first, right?
That's right. My lab wasn't experienced in using a gene therapy approach. We knew that the disease, in part, was based on the loss of this protein, and replacing the protein, or at least eventually getting more of the protein in the brain, could be a useful approach. And Jamie came into our life sort of as someone who could marriage the two labs together.
Mm-hmm. And so what happened?
Yeah. Well, so it was very different. Now, keep in mind that most academics work together with other colleagues. We weren't really used to having an outsider or a non-scientist come in and begin this process. And in reality, around the late 90s, this became a more common theme. There's actually another group that started doing the same thing, a group called Project ALS in New York City. And the idea was to bring laboratories together with varied different experience for them to collaborate and try to move things along faster, which is actually a great idea. Essentially, external forcing collaboration isn't so bad if the funds are there and the people are there to work on that project. So Matt's lab actually began building the gene therapy for EAAT2. And as he built these gene therapies, these constructs as we refer to them, we started testing them in my laboratory to see how well they worked, because it sounds good, but it's got to work. You've got to be able to build a reagent that you can use in patients ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, pick up the story.
Well, I came in on this story very early on. When Jamie was still at the Neurosciences Institute, a good friend of mine there, a neurobiologist named Ralph Greenspan, who had pointed me toward my previous book, which I had just published, called me up and said, "Have I got a story for you?" And I said, "That would make two," because the book was just sitting there on my desk. And Ralph told me the story of Jamie and Stephen, and I was drawn to it instantly, more than Ralph could have known, because we were dealing with a neurodegenerative disease in my own family. My mother had a still undiagnosed disease that was causing her to stumble and fall, and we didn't know what was going on, and we were all feeling very upset. The tentative diagnosis was something called Lewy body dementia, which is a sort of variant of Alzheimer's that's beginning to be more frequently diagnosed, as I understand it. I knew that we were up against it in the same way the Haywoods were, and hearing about Jamie's race moved me greatly. So I thought, I'll write a story about Jamie and Stephen for the New Yorker magazine, and I'll follow it. It's a story I have to tell, and it's also a story that might lead me to some answers at home. Mm-hmm.
Talking about the ALS this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, I'm Ira Flatow with author Jonathan Weiner and scientist Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein. So in the end, the push, I mean, he was very eager to get this therapy working and to try anything that he could. Did it succeed? What happened?
What happened was, you know, when I think about this story, when I watched it, I always think of the ancient Greek heroes who are trying to rescue someone from the underworld, and always happens, and you don't quite. It was that kind of agonizing turn. There was a tragic death in a gene therapy trial in Philadelphia, and remember, that's where Matt Turing, the gene therapist, is based. So just across town, another gene therapy trial killed a young man named Jesse Gelsinger.
That was a very famous case.
That's right. It became an enormous, explosive, controversial case, just as Jamie and his group were about to submit to the FDA to get permission for this gene therapy. And it became, you know, I think it was so hot, the reaction, partly because hopes were so high for the new biology that fears were correspondingly high. We were able to do anything. Well, maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe we're about to transform the human species. We were all talking about Dolly, the cloned sheep then. Mm-hmm. And the reaction maybe was disproportionately harsh against gene therapy, but it made it impossible to go forward, And Jamie changed gears very, very rapidly, turned on a dime. To his credit, in retrospect, I say to his credit, at the time I was almost shocked, and it was a rough ride for all of us following the story. But he changed gears and ended up trying a stem cell therapy for Stephen, which was again at the edge of medicine. That also, he did try it. It didn't do Stephen any harm, but it didn't arrest the progress of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Rothstein, is stem cell therapy now at the cutting edge of a possible treatment for ALS?
It's something in the future for ALS. There's no question. We spend an enormous – my laboratories, the group at Johns Hopkins, the Packard Center, and a group called Project ALS spent a lot of effort actually, in fact, over the last 4 years, trying to mature the field up, trying to get into the position where we actually can use those cells. And the reality is I think we will use them someday. Lessons learned, however, are that we have a lot of work to do in the laboratory to be prepared to use the right kind of cells, to know how to manipulate those cells, to know how to grow them up, and eventually to know how to put them properly into patients. And so there has been an enormous activity, not at the edge where patients know that it's going on, but it is going on. And I think we will use them someday. We're not just prepared to use them yet.
Jonathan?
I think that's quite right. Gene therapy was overhyped in the beginning years and years ago, and we realize now that it's still got a ways to go before it's going to be saving human lives, at least routinely. It's going to be quite a while till it's a routine medicine. And the same thing with stem cells. But we should be going full speed ahead learning how to use the stem cells, because we know it's going to take a while before we're going to be able to use them well. Mm-hmm. So Jamie was on the edge with both of those.
Mm. So let's talk. I'll take a break in a minute. But so where are Stephen and where are Jamie these days?
In the book, I left off at a sort of a cliffhanger.
I noticed,
as you know, yeah.
that's why I'm asking.
That's right, and everybody who reads it wants to know how are they now. Which I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that people have that reaction. They're doing better than they were in that cliffhanger moment last fall, when it looked as if Jamie's foundation was going to run out of cash in the new economic climate following that millennial boom. We had a bust, and Stephen is hanging in there.
All right, that's good to hear that. And we have to take a break. That's what the music means. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away. We'll talk more about ALS and Jonathan Weiner's book. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein, professor of neurology and neuroscience, the director of the Robert Packard Center for ALS Research and co-director of the MDA ALS Clinic at Johns Hopkins, and Jonathan Weiner, science writer in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and author of His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine, published by Echo Press. And oh, by the way, Jonathan is a Pulitzer Prize winner. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. So what happened to the foundation? You talked about a foundation that his brother was put together to keep fighting this disease.
That was a huge part of the effort from the beginning, because although the Haywoods are reasonably well off, they didn't have the kind of money that it takes to fund a race like this. So Jamie, being an entrepreneur, went and talked with other entrepreneurs who were very, very well off, who were willing to help and contribute a lot of cash. And Melinda, Jamie's wife, was a belly dancer who, with her sister Piper, belly danced at belly dance extravaganzas that they put together in order to help raise awareness and to raise money. And the grassroots fundraising that Jamie's foundation, ALS-TDF, began continues at a great rate and has tremendous support. Other ALS families have started foundations of their own in order to raise money for Jamie's foundation and his research. And then he, in those early days, he contributed a lot of money to other laboratories that were putting the work together.
Does he have a focus in mind of how his foundation should be working?
You know, he shocked me again with these very sharp turns in direction. What he decided to do after the gene therapy crashed and burned worldwide and the stem cells didn't help was to go back to the past to look at what drugs there are in the medicine chest that might be able to help, and then you wouldn't have to go through FDA approval because they're already approved. And that effort now continues, and he's built, I believe, the biggest animal testing facility for to do that kind of drug screening for ALS.
Just go through all the drugs and see what works.
See what works.
Yeah.
Follow leads, obviously. Don't just do it blindly, but follow leads and see what you can find. And that effort has helped to inspire other drug screening efforts going on. And I must say, it's Jamie's effort has helped to energize the whole area of ALS research, along with some others like Project ALS, so that research, I think Jeff will tell us, researchers are feeling energized and communicating more, and there's a tremendous sense of hope and forward motion in the field.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rothstein, is this a fruitful method of going looking for new drugs?
It's one of several, yes. I mean, the simple answer is yes. Looking at the existing population of drugs, the FDA-approved drugs, is not a bad route. It won't necessarily give you the optimum drug, mm-hmm. but the reality is that most pharmaceutical companies aren't helping us much to find drugs for ALS or not targeting the disease.
Why is that? Why?
Money.
Money. Is it classified as an orphan disease?
It's an orphan disease. There are approximately 30,000 patients a year have the disease. There would be more, but patients don't live very long. Mm-hmm. So there's not a lot of money to be made in developing a drug for ALS. Unfortunately, the reality is that they don't understand that in many cases developing a drug for ALS, that drug could be useful for other degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, where money is to be had for those large companies. But the fact remains that they don't really, for the most part, I'm being general here, across mm-hmm. the board, invest in ALS or ALS clinical trials. And that leaves a lot of the work on the back of academics, which is fine. We know the disease well and we can pursue things, but we're not drug development or organizations, so we're not optimized for finding new drugs. So in turn, what we've done over the years is actually turn, especially recently by a great effort sponsored by the NIH, to look at existing FDA-approved drugs and see what's there, mm-hmm. see if there's something we can mine. Many neurologists, as a specialist like myself, know that a drug used for one disease often over time gets used for other diseases quite successfully. So we can set up screening programs, which we have, both in ALS mice, as mentioned that Jamie had done, and probably and even better maybe by using small cell culture dishes. We've learned that the mice are and we've only inherently indirectly talked about them. That's a model was developed in the mid-90s, a model based on the familial form of ALS mm-hmm. that's used to understand the disease and actually screen for therapies. But it also may miss because it really is a form of the rare form of ALS, and we might be missing drugs that would otherwise work in the more common form of ALS. Mm-hmm. So we use multiple approaches today to find drugs, again, in hopes of getting something as quickly as possible to patients.
Mm-hmm. What did you take away with your own personal experience with your own mother on this, Jonathan?
Well, my mother continued to decline, and we got a diagnosis different from the first, which, again, is common with these diseases. It seems she has something called progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP, which is even more of an orphan, if that's possible, than ALS. It's even rarer. Many experts in rare diseases, lobbyists in Washington who campaign for greater funding, haven't heard of PSP. For a brief while, it looked as if following this story might lead to something for my mother, too. Matt Turing at Jefferson offered to try to come up with still another radical approach, a brain vaccine that might be of help. We looked at that. My father and I talked about it. But at that moment in late 99, it was already too late for my mom, and she was declining so fast then that it would have been pointless to subject her to a highly risky experimental treatment. There wasn't enough of her to save already. But that was a very intense moment for me, and it illuminated for me just how much responsibility Jamie had taken on. Just the thought that I might do that, and that I might be able to help her or even save her, but that I would take the responsibility of putting her through an experimental treatment was, for me, momentous. Mm-hmm. And gave me that much more admiration for what Jamie has taken on his shoulders.
Let me see if I can get a phone call or, in, or two before we have to go. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Cindy in Chico, California. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I'm a member of KCHO in Chico, California. And my mom has ALS, and I finding that the situation is...
Cindy, are you there?
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm finding that the situation seems so frustrating because right now it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of hope for ALS patients right now. All of the research seems like it's so far in advance. So for those patients who are diagnosed right now and, you know, are in the later stages of the disease, you know, is it just basically that we can expect that there's nothing that we can do for them?
Dr. Rothstein?
Well, in a general way, there's actually a lot of hope. There's a lot going on in the disease, a lot of research now, far more than a decade ago, and I've been doing this for well over a decade, to find new drugs and therapies. The caller brings up a difficult problem. So one of the exciting things is that we're always, in fact, every year we've had multiple different new drugs to try in patients. But those are experimental trials, and experimental trials are experiments. They have certain criteria, and as the caller calls in, if her mom's in the later stages of the diseases, most trials, not all, but most trials don't allow those patients into our experimental trials. We often include only patients early in the disease, the point being so we can really learn if the drugs will slow the disease down. And so that is difficult, but in a general way, there's really a lot going on. There are lots of new trials right now. There are at least three or four trials going on for new drugs for ALS.
And how do they attack the disease, and what method?
So that's a good question. There's sort of a couple different ways. Neurologic diseases, adult onset like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, are generally about cells that are dying. And when you lose a brain cell, you lose it for good. It's not like when you cut yourself shaving and the body heals itself. Brain doesn't do that for the most part. So drugs are typically designed to slow the process down. We call them neuroprotective drugs. The alternative approach about fixing dead cells is really where we get into the realm of stem cells. And finally, in terms of developing protective drugs, there's just different biochemical pathways, molecular pathways that we target. And some of those are simple drugs, small molecules. When I say small molecules, it's just the equivalent of things like aspirin. Or we use approaches like gene therapy, where we put in not small molecules, but we put in actual proteins. And those are plans on the horizon as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about ALS this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You yourself, are you involved in any of these in particular? Dr. Rothstein?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, very involved.
Which one do you think would you put your money on, so to speak?
Oh, patients ask me that all the time. I don't, actually. I actually believe that any opportunity is a good opportunity for patients. We're intimately involved. We're the main center that will be planning and carrying out a gene therapy trial, we hope, in a year. We discover new drugs. The trial that's going on right now in the United States has come from our laboratories. Mm-hmm. We're pretty plugged in for finding new drugs and or gene therapies. And in the future, we're working on stem cells. Right now, there are several new drugs that are coming out. I always advise patients, if there's something out there available, there's every reason to try it. And the main reason is because an experimental trial is an experiment. We hypothesize the drug would work. We really don't know one can work any better than the other. So every experiment's worth trying.
Mm-hmm. And someone who is diagnosed with ALS, what do you recommend that they do immediately?
The first thing is I always recommend they try to align themselves with neurologists or clinics that have experience with ALS. Because
how do you find them?
Actually, there are great websites for that. There are two major national organizations. Well, there's three, really. There's always the NIH. The NIH has a very generic website. The two national organizations that are heavily involved in ALS are the Muscular Dystrophy Association. They have a great website. And the ALS Association, again, both have websites. They often list the clinics around the country. Mm-hmm. And if you're not even sure, if you live near a major city, call the local university, the University Medical Center, because most universities around the country have an ALS clinic. Some mm-hmm. are larger than others. But I always recommend patients, if they have that opportunity, now that may not apply to rural America, but if they have that opportunity to go to a neurologist, or a nurse practitioner that has experience in the disease. Because as exciting as it is for us to talk about new drugs and new therapies, the reality is for the patient today, they need good medical management, good nutritional care, good pulmonary breathing management, good physical therapy. All of those help. They don't cure the disease, but they help a patient manage a terrible disease.
Jonathan Weiner, any running out of time, any last thoughts on your experiences with it and how it's affected you and your mother and knowing these two brothers?
You know, I'm a science writer. I've been writing about science for all of my career, and I've never been as moved and as caught up in a story as I was following the Haywoods and learning about the edge of medicine. I think this is where science meets our lives most intimately, and sometimes painfully, and sometimes even hope can be painful in some situations. It's been a fascinating emotional as well as intellectual education for me, and I'm left with tremendous admiration for the doctors and researchers who are pushing forward.
Did you read Jerry Grootman's book on hope?
I've been so hurrying with mine, I haven't had a chance yet, but I want to read that.
Yeah. Last word from you, Dr. Rothstein?
I think this, as Jonathan's well put together, this is an exciting time for those of us that work in this terrible disease. Groups like the Jamie's put together, groups like Project ALS, even the Packard Center at Hopkins, all these groups in alliance with the larger groups have really made a difference for us to move quickly in research, and that's what we need to do for this disease. We need to move and energize and collaborate as quickly as possible to find these answers for patients, and I'm quite convinced we will.
And certainly with the aging population, you might see more of these cases. I'd like to thank you both for joining me, Dr. Jeffrey Rothstein, Professor of Neurology and Neuroscience, Director of the Robert Packard Center for ALS Research, and Co-Director of the MDA ALS Clinic at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, and Jonathan Weiner. He's a science writer in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, a well-known author, Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book is His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine, published by Echo Press. It's a very, very interesting story. I highly recommend it. Thank you, Jonathan, for coming in today.
Thank you.
Earlier, we spoke with Richard Gibbs of Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rigo Cardi in New York. And Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Wileski and Alphonse Finn. If you missed anything that we talked about today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also send mail the classic mail way, Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Also, surf over to our website, Science Friday's Kids Connection there. We have a free teaching material. Also, you can download Science Friday on your Audible player. Have a great weekend and a great holiday season. Passover and Easter. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.